This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh for a special edition of Movies on the Radio with a live audience here in the auditorium at the North Carolina Museum of Art. We just screened the 1941 film Citizen Kane. It tells the story of Charles Foster Kane, a character modeled after media magnate William Randolph Hearst. The film's daring subject matter, bold visuals, and unique style made Orson Welles a household name and gave that film a lasting legacy. We're going to hear audience feedback, take some questions from you in just a bit, but first I'm joined by our regulars on Movies on the Radio, film experts Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University. Marcia, welcome.
Thank you.
And Laura Boyes, film curator right here at the North Carolina Museum of Art.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, I'll start right in. The big question, this is on everybody's list of the all-time greatest films ever made. Talk about some of the things that make it that, the best film ever.
Well, it was so different from conventional Hollywood storytelling. There's not a romance or a happy ending. The timeline is extremely splintered. It goes forward, it goes back. It tells the same story in different perspectives. And visually, it's very bold. The deep focus in which something in the back is in focus the same time as the front had never really been seen on the screen before. The music mix is very unusual. Orson Welles was a radio guy, and so he had overlapping conversations. He had very dramatic and incisive music, and sometimes he just had silence.
He's a very young man, Orson Welles, when he directs this film, his very first film, 26 years old. Let's talk about Orson Welles as a filmmaker. The visuals, as we say, are amazing, and yet the soundscape is also ingenious, and that we would expect from a radio guy.
Absolutely. Although, also, this is Bernard Herrmann's first film, and he talks about the fact that this was an extraordinary opportunity to really collaborate with someone who was an outsider. And that was one of the things that was threatening about this film, is that here comes this young guy who's given basically carte blanche by RKO, the studio for whom he made this film, to do what he wanted to do once he got script approval. And so he really went and did things that, it's not that they hadn't been done before, they just hadn't been done this way. So for example, Deep Focus, you can find that in earlier films from France in the 1930s, but not with this kind of relentless scene after scene, these long takes, the sonic environment where there's these cues that like tell you what's going on basically throughout the film. You keep returning to the same sets of notes that Bernard Herrmann composed, or these really complex kind of sonic bridges between spaces. This was all very experimental when it all came together. And so part of it was, you know, if you don't know the rules, you get to make them up. And so Welles came in and, you know, as the boy genius, kind of got to work with both people who were new in the industry and then amazing veterans like Greg Toland, who did the cinematography, who really helped him realize that vision.
And that's what Orson Welles said to an interviewer who asked him how he was able to come up with these great innovations. And he said, ignorance. He just didn't know any better. And Toland actually loved that about him.
Absolutely.
The fact that he could exploit the fact that you don't know what you can't do, and I'm a cinematographer, this is going to be great, right?
And it's also very surprising how many faces are in shadow or in darkness. And this is so anti what Hollywood is all about, which is, you know, the beautiful face for you to admire on the screen. And here, often, you couldn't see the people who were speaking, which of course is also a radio thing I realized just tonight, is, for example, how many of you were guessing what Frank Stacio looked like, and now you see him right in front of you.
Well, and also there's...
I want to ask about your disappointment.
Right. There's no movie stars in this movie.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
At those final credits where you get introduced to these players that Welles had been working with for many years in theater and on the radio, this is not your typical Hollywood production. At this time is star-driven. So every film is cast according to stars, and everything circulates around that. And so to bring in a cast of unknown performers, relatively speaking,
right,
who are really actors, and to pull off something like the aging that happens in this film, which, you know, you can look at some of the makeup and go, okay, but, you know, this is pretty extraordinary feat to considering the age that Orson Welles was when he made this film and that range of performance from beginning to end.
Let's talk about some of the layering, too, that we talked about earlier. The sound layering, for instance, there's a great scene in here where we've got Charles Foster Kane playing in the snow, juxtaposed against his parents sitting in the house. They're signing him away, and he's out there, and we're hearing him playing in the snow, and then this torturous exchange that's going on between the broker Thatcher and his parents. Let's listen.
Come on, boys! We're Union first!
Be careful, Charles!
Kane.
Pull your muffler around your neck, Charles.
Kane, I think we shall have to tell him now.
Yes. I'll sign those papers now, Mr. Thatcher.
You people seem to forget that I'm the boy's father.
It's going to be done exactly the way I've told Mr. Thatcher.
There ain't nothing wrong with Colorado. I don't see why we can't raise our own son just because we come into some money. If I want, I can go to court. A father has a right to.
I mean, that's the kind of thing we would expect from a radio guy, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, but then visually, that is one of the most extraordinary scenes because that's one of those examples of this beautiful deep focus photography where you see the young boy out in the deep field while his parents are arguing over his fate. And there's this kind of series of triangular patterns that get established between the man who's going to take the son away and the father, who is obviously in a position of no power whatsoever. You know, the mother who is lording over all of this, and then Charles out there in the snow globe of his environment before he goes off into the world. And so we see and we hear all of this at every level of the frame, foreground, middle ground, and in the deep field.
And of course, it's the first of many compositions in which somebody is framed in a doorway or a window, and then you back away and back away and back away as if, you know, everything has so many layers.
Well, and this deep focus also allowed for some nice visual effects and optical illusions when Charles Foster Kane is signing away his business to Thatcher, right there in this office, and you see these windows in the background in focus, and they look pretty normal, and then he walks back toward the windows, and suddenly he's dwarfed by what appear to be very large windows.
Oh yeah, and a lot of the trick photography too, like going in when the interview of Susan happens going through the window, which is kind of an iteration of a shot from Fritz Lang's M from about a decade prior to it, but done in this kind of very artful, very impactful way. So
and ceilings. When I never thought about this before, but apparently ceilings were not a thing you saw in movies.
Right, it was one of the first films in which the camera has this extreme low angle and you look up at people silhouetted against the ceiling.
Because obviously Hollywood sets didn't need ceilings and so you didn't have them, right?
Right.
And I was also thinking, I'm not sure whether I've ever seen this film on the big screen before. I've seen it so many times, you know, on television, you know, VHS, DVD, TCM, all of this. But when people walk back into the screen, it almost looks like they're walking behind the screen. It's a very intense kind of optical illusion.
Yeah, when I think especially those scenes that happen in the newspaper office where the ceiling is most prominent and Charles looks the kind of largest and most looming in the film, that's obviously done to great effect to have that slightly lower angle with the ceiling, you know, always present in the frame.
Let's talk about the story itself and how that came about. I know that Orson Welles himself was thinking about a kind of a Rashomon-like movie, and this would have been a decade before Rashomon, right? Mm-hmm. But the idea of a story told from many perspectives. So he'd been thinking about that. How did this particular story come together?
Well, so this particular story was written by Mankiewicz, and although certainly Orson Welles had some participation in this, it was really not co-authored in exactly that kind of collaborative way. It was a Mankiewicz screenplay. And obviously it's based a lot on William Randolph Hearst, the yellow journalist, and impresario of Hearst Castle in San Simeon. And so there's a lot of him in that, but it's also just a kind of amalgam of someone who gets a lot of power and is able to do whatever they want with it. And it really struck me tonight watching it. I mean, what a sad, sad film it is. I mean, regardless of what you think of Rosebud, which I'm sure we'll end up speaking about a lot, it's really, the sense of loss you get in this film is very palpable.
Well, it's very sad, and it's also amazing to me in 1941 you could take on these themes. I'm not sure what films were dealing with in 1941, but the idea that you would take, give materialism at least, and capitalism, a couple of body blows in this whole film, it's really not sympathetic at all to our way of doing things. But it's not a melodrama because it also looks at who is in any position to change the system. And there's a real sense that if you were ever in a position to change what is a ruthless system, you're likely to be co-opted and a part of it, so nobody really escapes. That's maybe the saddest thing of all.
Yeah, and this is also, this film also fits in a long lineage of newspaper films. There's a lot of films about journalists that are made in the 1930s and the 1940s, most prominently maybe thinking about something like The Front Page, which was also made as His Girl Friday. But the subject of journalism was kind of endlessly fascinating, no doubt in part because so many journalists ended up writing for Hollywood, including Mankiewicz. So they really knew that world and that kind of fast-paced dialogue and the idea of people who have power over the press have this incredible ability to manipulate the world and to do things that are not always ethical.
And Kane was such a bully. And he had a platform for his demagoguery, and he felt there was no limit to what he could do until he found out that there was.
A charming and lovable bully with no limit to what he can do in running for public office. Thank God that'll never happen
again. I know. It's really kind of terrifying that you say,
This was a long time ago.
This film was made so long ago, yeah. But sadly it kind of set your teeth on edge for so many reasons.
You are listening to a special edition of Movies on the Radio recorded at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. We're talking about Citizen Kane with film experts Laura Boys and Marsha Gordon, and we'll continue that conversation on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Today we're at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh for a special edition of our Movies on the Radio series. We screened the 1941 film Citizen Kane, and we're going to take some questions and comments from our audience in a moment. But first, we continue our conversation with our Movies on the Radio experts, Marsha Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University, and Laura Boys, film curator here at North Carolina's Museum of Art. Let's talk a little bit about the music in this film. It is extraordinary. You talked a little bit about it earlier, Laura, but tell us more about how music was used in this film.
Well, it was obviously used to underscore individual characters so that you had a sense of what somebody's personality was from the movies, from the music, rather.
Oh, well, and I think one of the amazing things, so Bernard Herrmann got to really work in a collaborative way with Wells. The typical way that a movie composer would work at this time period is they would see the completed film and then make the music go with it. And Herrmann actually worked for 12... Herrmann, by the way, is probably best known as Alfred Hitchcock's regular composer. So if you've heard Herrmann's name, that's why. So he actually spent 12 weeks collaborating with Wells to make a very, very rich sonic atmosphere, not just the composed music, but also all of the other kinds of sounds that you hear in the film. So he was really present. He saw the dailies, and he was there working in a much more collaborative way than would be normal for a composer.
I mean, it's like a soundscape. I could feel that. It's different than scoring a film or having incidental music. Also, we talked about, you mentioned earlier, Marsha, that newspapers and the press was a big topic of the film industry back then. But this was really pointed in many ways at Hearst himself. And of course, Mankiewicz was a guy who had a personal experience with him, right?
I mean, they knew each other quite well, and had spent a good amount of time together. And the kind of circumstances for the making of this film, I mean, it was pretty hush-hush during the making. Wells did a fairly good job of keeping a closed set. But then, of course, there's a certain point at which your film has to go out into the world. And when word got to Hearst, who controlled a lot of the newspapers in this country, about what this was about, I mean, there were threats. There were threats of lawsuits. There was an alleged moment where Louis B. Mayer was kind of approached RKO and offered to pay for the cost of the film for it not to be released. And the legend is that this film was like not reviewed, no one saw it. And that's not true. You know, I've been doing research on the reviews. The reviews were very, very positive in the New York Times, in the LA Times, in Variety. People called it astonishing, bravado, you know, art, etc. But indeed, the Hearst newspapers, you know, were silent on the matter. And there was a lot of pressure exerted on theaters not to show the film. So it did not have as wide of a release as it would have had had there not been that pressure.
And what Hearst was upset about was not so much the way he was depicted, but the fact that he felt it was a slur on his longtime mistress, Marion Davies, who in fact was nothing like the character played by Susan Alexander, who was a witty and delightful person, a very accomplished actress, very well reviewed, and in fact, supposedly, the Rosebud in particular, which was something I guess Herman Mankiewicz might have known, was a private nickname that he had for her that he did not want on screen. So his great umbrage was largely with the way the Susan Alexander character was portrayed.
But there certainly could be no doubt that this film took aim at Hearst himself. I mean, think about this scene. We'll play this scene right now. Essentially, how to run a newspaper. Let's listen.
Is that really your idea of how to run a newspaper?
I don't know how to run a newspaper, Mr. Thatcher. I just try everything I can think of.
Todd, you know perfectly well there's not the slightest proof that this armada's off the Jersey
Hello,
coast.
Mr. Bernstein.
Excuse me, Mr.
Can you
Kane.
Prove it isn't?
This just
Mr. Bernstein,
in.
I'd like you to meet Mr. Thatcher.
I'll just borrow
How do you
it
do, Mr. Thatcher?
Leland,
Hello.
Mr. Thatcher, my ex-guardian.
From Cuba.
We have no secrets from our readers, Mr. Bernstein. Mr. Thatcher is one of our most devoted readers. He knows what's wrong with every copy of the Inquirer since I took over.
Now, tell me... Honestly, my boy, don't you think it's rather unwise to continue this philanthropic enterprise, this Inquirer that's costing you $1 million a year?
You're right, Mr. Thatcher. I did lose $1 million last year. I expect to lose $1 million this year. I expect to lose $1 million next year. You know, Mr. Thatcher, at the rate of $1 million a year, I'll have to close this place in 60 years.
You talked about the fact that the film had some pretty good reviews, Marcia, but actually it didn't make a lot of money.
Well, no. I mean, what's interesting, though, is if you read the press accounts of box office, there were theaters where it was killing it. The problem was because of Hearst's exertion of this pressure on theaters at a time when theaters were no longer vertically integrated. This is the beginning of the disintegration of the studio system. And so theaters felt afraid because if you crossed Hearst, I mean, he could do a lot of damage to you very, very easily with smear campaigns. There were threats about all kinds of things. If, you know, if you had foreigners working for your, you know, company, for your, you know, in your theater system, you could basically be slurred in the press for being subversive. It's all the kind of Red Scare stuff is in the air. And so it did not do what it should have done at the box office based on, A, all the attention. I mean, the scandal with Hearst, this was in the papers. This was not in the Hearst papers, but this was in the papers. This was being talked about. This was not some secret behind-the-scenes Hollywood thing. So I was thinking about this. I was like, this is like The Interview of 1941, which is everyone's like, oh, no, you can't show that film. We want to see that film, right? but then it just did not make the kind of money. But it was also not a total disaster.
Well, it posted an official loss of $150,000 when RKO put it away with obviously no intent to re-release it because of the pressure from the Hearst Empire.
So how did it get to our attention and how has it become the number one on so many lists? When did it start to get better reviews?
Well, after World War II, it began to be championed by the Cahiers du Cinéma people. François Truffaut and André Bazin found it to be extremely compelling, started to write about it. It then became pretty standard fare at college film societies in the 1950s and 60s. And then Peter Bogdanovich wrote a very famous introduction to it at a screening at the Museum of Modern Art in 1961. And Peter Bogdanovich became a very close friend of Orson Welles. He wrote a wonderful book on him, This is Orson Welles. And so steadily it began to be rediscovered.
And Pauline Kael wrote the amazing book about Citizen Kane, which included the script that Mankiewicz wrote. And so, of course, Kael at the time was such a powerful critic. I think that had
this
a lot
was,
of
this was
power.
In the 1970s.
Yes, exactly. It had a lot of power over people returning to the film.
Well, let's talk about that one word in the film that Roger Ebert said in 2004. He thought that Rosebud was the most famous word in the history of cinema. Let's listen. So what about that and all the themes that it evokes? Because really, the question of the corruption of power and how this can, you know, sort of turn us all into narcissists is one of the themes we haven't even talked about yet.
Yeah, well, I mean, first, I'm going to tell a story on myself, which is I remember seeing this film for the first time. I was probably 19. I was in college, but it was not for a class. And I got to the end of it, and I remember saying, "It's a sled." I mean, this is so embarrassing, but you know, it's funny because Welles used to refer to this as like the dollar book Freud moment, and it's hard to tell if that was kind of covering up something with a joke or not, but the point is it's everything and it's nothing, right? I mean, the idea, even within the film, of the jigsaw puzzle and that one thing can explain someone's life is preposterous, and yet it's this great hook that gives us the detective story that is the film, right? Everything is reliant on this idea of the quest to find out what Rosebud is and that it somehow is going to unlock the mystery of Kane and his childhood and whatever traumatized him, but it's also nothing.
Right. Well, it was described as a labyrinth without a center. You know, the fact that when you go to a Hollywood movie and they tell you that there's a mystery, you say, oh, you know, A, B, C, D is going to happen, and then the solution will be revealed and it will be a satisfying solution to the mystery. And Kane holds that back from you. I mean, you had the exact reaction, I think, at 19 that you were supposed to have in a way.
Yeah, but it does. I mean, you're right. It undoes all of the tropes of Hollywood at the time and all of the scheme, right? I mean, it doesn't have a satisfying ending. And ultimately, it would be a cheap kind of a dime store psychological trick if you really believe that was the intent of the film. It doesn't answer the question.
Yeah, absolutely. And in that way, this film has a very strong European feel to me. And it's not just the kind of sense of dissatisfaction and not having a lot of the conventions, but I think it takes a lot from German expressionism, just in terms of the use of shadow and light. In fact, Toland, I think, was very influenced by some of the great German cinematographers that came to this country fleeing the Nazis in the 1930s.
Bernard Herrmann had done as
and
well.
And Bernard Herrmann as well. And so that kind of European sensibility is another thing that I think made this film a little bit less palatable to kind of mainstream audiences, because I think even the reviews that were really positive about this film often said, "I'm not sure this is a film for everyone." In other words, there was kind of an acknowledgement from the beginning that there was something sophisticated and unusual and interesting and exciting about this film, but that it wasn't blockbuster fare.
Well, one thing we can never really know is what did his theater productions look like? Because in a way, the light and the shadow, the spotlights on things, they're very theatrical. And he was a very revolutionary kind of theater director. He was very famous for doing a version of Macbeth that had an entirely African-American cast at a time when that sort of thing just wasn't done. So I have a feeling that some of it, yes, is certainly influenced by German expressionism, but to me it's a very theater-bound kind of visual aesthetic as well.
Well, and I think what he said was when they asked again, they were asking Orson Welles, how did you do this? It's your first film. He said it was the first time he'd ever been on a movie set, was day one of his directing career for this movie. And he said that he got most of his guidance from John Ford's Stagecoach, which he apparently watched 40 or 50 times.
Yeah, I never know how much to believe anything Welles said about anything.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Right. He He was an excellent storyteller.
And again, a guy, a theater background, a radio background. This is his first foray into films, and yet this is a film. This could only be a film, right? I mean, all of the great cinematography and some of the tricks that we've talked about that made this film what it is, and you can't imagine this done any other way.
Well, and we haven't really talked about the editing. Robert Wise, who was the editor on this film, who went on to direct, you know, a few films you may have heard of, like The Sound of Music, The Day the Earth Stood Still, so he had a really tremendous career. The editing of this film is tremendous. The pacing, in some ways, to me, is very modern. It's very fast-paced. For a film that has this kind of weighty, the story of a life subject matter, I mean, I think sometimes people anticipate, like, oh, this is going to be a snoozer. You know, I'm going to be looking at my watch. But in fact, it just keeps going along. And part of it is the way that these sequences, you know, are edited together. For example, the entire story of a marriage in one sequence that's so wonderfully edited with that whip pan that we get the passage of time and we get these little kind of moments.
Well, after the first couple of months, she and Charlie didn't see much of each other except at breakfast. It was a marriage just like any other marriage.
His timeline created an interest just in the fact that you didn't have that forward progression.
No, I mean, it's amazing that he torpedoed that whole formula before it was a formula.
I've never been to six parties one extremely night in my beautiful whole life. I've never even been up this late.
It's a matter of habit.
I wonder what the servants will think.
They'll think we enjoyed ourselves.
Yes.
Didn't we?
I don't see why you have to go straight out to the newspaper.
You never should have married a newspaper man. They're worse than sailors. I absolutely adore you.
Charles, even newspaper men have to sleep.
I'll call Mr. Bernstein, have him put off my appointments until noon.
Charles, do you know how long you kept me waiting last night while you went to the newspaper for 10 minutes?
Emily, my dear, your only correspondent is the Inquirer.
Sometimes I think I'd prefer a rival of flesh and blood.
Oh, Emily, I don't spend that much time on the newspaper.
It isn't just the time. It's what you print, attacking the president.
You mean Uncle John?
I mean the president of the United States.
He's still Uncle John. He's still a well-meaning fathead who's
Charles.
Letting a pack of high-pressure crooks run his administration. This whole oil scandal.
He happens to be the president, Charles, not you.
That's a mistake that will be corrected one of these days.
Your Mr. Bernstein sent Junior the most incredible atrocity yesterday, Charles. I simply can't have it in the nursery.
Mr. Bernstein is apt to pay a visit to the nursery now and then.
Does he have to?
Yes.
Really, Charles? People will think...
What I tell them to think.
Well, and even the moments that are repeated, and the key one to me is the excruciating scene of Susan Alexander's opera debut. It's the one moment in the film that is actually repeated exactly as it is. It's that moment where she comes out on the stage and they're frenetically getting her ready and they're putting her hair together, and then she's, you know, in front of the dark, beautiful shot of the complete black from behind her space of the auditorium, and she's up there on the stage. And even the decision to just verbatim repeat visually and sonically a moment like that, it drives home the pain of that moment for her.
Anymore.
No. Please don't make us listen to the whole opera again. Right. And yet, you do. Not only do you have to listen to it so much, right? We get the rehearsals, we get it home, we get the actual opera, and then we hear it again later in that scene where she's leaving him. That music is playing again in a different form in the background. And that's also a device that's used in that breakfast scene that I just mentioned, which is it starts off with this kind of waltz, and it just gets twisted as it goes along, and the music changes a little bit, but Herman talks about the fact that he really very deliberately took a joyous form in the beginning of the marriage and just tweaked it a little bit throughout the course of that sequence.
So what about the influence of this film? We talked about all the innovations and what makes it the greatest film ever. Did people pick up on it? Have we seen it in films since?
Well, I mean, that's a great question. I think Everyone who saw this film within the industry was kind of blown away by some of the technique, even though Welles was, he was an upstart and an outsider. In the Academy Awards, for example, for this year, the only award that this won was Best Original Screenplay, which was really considered a dig at Welles and his outsiderness, and also a kind of tacit support for Hearst. But
and in fact, it was the only Oscar he ever won in his entire career was this shared one with Mankiewicz for
right,
the screenplay.
Right. But I certainly think that in terms of pop culture, there are very few films that have had as many references as this one. I mean, there are moments in Charlie Brown, there are moments in The Simpsons. So many of you had not seen the film tonight, but you probably all knew about Rosebud, even if you didn't know what Rosebud was, right? It's something that you hear. And so I think, in terms of its kind of status in the culture, almost from the moment before it was released, when it was already legend because of, the way that it was taking on Hearst, that it had that kind of impact.
Well, let's talk about the context. You've seen this film before. You saw it again tonight. I don't know how long it's been, but you told us about the Rosebud story, certainly. But what about you, Laura, in terms of seeing it again tonight? Anything different for you? Anything new for you?
Well, I really, as I mentioned before, I really was struck by all of the shadowy faces. I thought that was really an interesting and bold
choice. Yeah, well, how'd you
choice.
Like to be that reporter? We never saw the he's the
we never
guy
saw
who's,
the reporter.
He's trying to dig out the story, looking for Rosebud, and we never see the guy.
I love the research facility. I forgot how wonderful when he goes to read the manuscript, and there's that really mean archivist woman who's like, "You have 2 minutes, and you can only read these pages." And he's, actually, that's one of my favorite parts of this film in general, is just this idea of chasing after what a life is and just all the different perspectives. And I think Joseph Cotten's character is so fantastic. The performances, I think, are fantastic. Agnes Moorehead as mm-hmm. the mother, this kind of stern, and she's only in the film for such a short period mm-hmm. of time, but she's so high impact. And, Joseph Cotten, I think, does an incredible job.
Yeah, she worked with Welles quite a lot, and I just think he's fantastic.
Great scene, great film. We're going to continue our conversation here at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. It's Movies on the Radio. We screened the 1941 film Citizen Kane, and we're going to take questions and comments from our audience here in Raleigh. Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University. Laura Boies, film curator at North Carolina's Museum of Art. And we'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio at the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh today with a special edition of our Movies on the Radio series. We screened the 1941 film, Citizen Kane. Now we're going to take questions from our audience, but I'm also joined by our film experts, Marcia Gordon from North Carolina State University and Laura Boies, film curator right here at the North Carolina Museum of Art. I do want to ask one more question before we go to the audience. What happened to Orson Welles' career after this? I mean, this is a tough thing to top, right, at 26 years old when you create a film like this. Talk about what this did for him.
This was not an easy situation for him. First of all, RKO had originally given him a 3-picture deal with kind of carte blanche over the films, and that got changed after this. And his next film, Magnificent Ambersons, was taken a lot out of his control. But I think Welles had an extraordinary, interesting, fascinating career, including some films that I absolutely adore, like Touch of Evil, for example, and Mr. Arkadin, and F for Fake. Some films that, are relatively not well-known in comparison to Citizen Kane. Obviously, that's the one that everyone knows. But he struggled. I mean, he absolutely, went up and down in his career, had a lot of lows. And this, being the boy wonder, and at 25, getting to do this, and having done War of the Worlds in 1938, which we haven't even talked about, those are pretty high marks to hit before you're 25. Yeah. And so it's hard not to experience, I think, some lows after a start like that.
But of course, he also had an extraordinary career as an actor, which he did primarily to make money, to make his own films, because he spent so much time having to self-finance after he lost his RKO contract. And he was amazing in The Third Man, which we're going to be showing in January. I love him as Mr. Rochester in Jane Eyre. He was in other thrillers, World War II thrillers.
The Stranger.
Journey into Fear. So he's a remarkable actor as well as a director.
And of course, he became like this really interesting, quirky personality, doing advertisements for wine and going on talk shows and, you know, making money, you know, everywhere he could. And so, and a lot of that was to try to fund his own projects.
Let's take some questions from the audience. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is John Wren. I wondered how much the circumstances leading up to the world wars in Europe and the rest of the world affected the contents and so forth of this movie.
1941.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't really know exactly how to answer it, except to say that there are those references to what's happening in Europe that are very kind of quick in the film. And obviously, this is 1941, but it's well before December. I forget what month this film came out. Does anyone know?
It was before Pearl Harbor.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Absolutely.
But I mean, he was very interested in politics. I mean, that's why he would take on a subject like William Randolph Hearst, even though he always joked that it was really about Robert McCormick, who was the farm machinery.
I did think about that, because there's that pointed moment in the film where he looks right at the camera and says, "There will not be war." And
right.
It's obviously so ironic. And I thought, wait, he shot this in 1940.
Well, and obviously one of the things that the film is interested in, there's those references to the Spanish-American War and to the ability of journalists to drum up pro or anti-war sentiment and to really control our political involvement in something like a war, which on the one hand seems incredibly absurd, but is an absolute reality that media controls people's perceptions of whether or not, as a nation, we should get involved in military conflicts then as now.
Would that that were so. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Sean Moore, and my question is, I'd like to hear you talk about the influence the film had on subsequent films, particularly in the area of film noir.
I think you're absolutely right to point to film noir as a major inheritor of some of these things. It's hard to ever say this led to this. Certainly, when I think about film noir, I think about German expressionism having influenced it. But is that filtered partly through Citizen Kane? Yes, absolutely. And the way that that's reflected there. But the use of darkness and shadows and mystery, not to mention some of the kind of photographic techniques, I think that's very palpable in that particular kind of film, which becomes very popular over the course of the 1940s and is another kind of film that the French really look to when they're looking at American cinema after the war and identify as something spectacular and very American.
And it's also an anti-hero. I mean, certainly film noir was involved with characters that were not necessarily admirable, and I think you would probably say that about Kane as well.
Absolutely.
Yes, sir.
My name is Graham. I was wondering, special effects in this film, you obviously notice there's very dramatic lighting, there's dramatic camera angles, they're using kind of different lenses in the film than maybe were used at the time. What did they use, and how did that influence other films?
First off, I don't think there was anything that they kind of pioneered. I know that Toland had some special lenses made to do some of the deep focus work, because that's not easy to do, to get really crisp images at all of those levels of the field. But in terms of the special effects, I mean, you can see that, you know, matte paintings are used widely in, you know, The Wizard of Oz, shooting in mirrors, things like that. You can find examples of all of that. Jean Renoir did a lot of these kind of photographic things in the 1930s with depth of field. So it's not so much that they invented any processes that I'm aware of for this particular film. It's really more that they so assertively and boldly used them throughout. And so I think it's kind of interesting when you look at a film like this, so many of the scenes, I mean, you can even see the kind of artifice at work. It's not that it's trying to bury it. And actually, that's one of the ways in which I think this film differs from a lot of classical Hollywood cinema of the time. Classical Hollywood cinema depended on kind of erasing all signs of its its artifice.
There's a very dramatic use of foreground in this movie that is different from a lot of films that have gone before, like during Susan's suicide scene, where you see, you know, the glass and the bottle that takes the front part of the screen. To me, that's something that maybe they would have done in the silent era, but was certainly not a part of conventional Hollywood
visuals. I think what we're getting at, though, is partly style. This film had a lot of style, and it had a distinct style that it really carved out. And even in the use of deep focus, that like the scene where Susan leaves, and you see her in the deep field, and then we see the other shot of Kane in the deep field.
Yeah, I love
but
that.
Using that so relentlessly, but really for dramatic effect that calls us kind of out of the artifice.
Do you think the matte paintings, there were a couple of moments and some of those paintings that I thought, well, that's a painting, but it's kind of beautiful, and I really love it, and I'm glad they did that. How obvious would that have been to the moviegoer of 1941?
They had eyes in 1941, and indeed would have seen that. It's kind of like Wizard of Oz, you know, which is 1939. There's matte paintings used throughout that film that nobody would have ever looked at and gone, wow, that's really a poppy field, or that's really, you know, a castle or whatever.
But as a kid, you believe it completely. You don't look at it as a painting.
I don't know. I'm not sure. If you asked a kid, you know, is that a dimensional field or a castle? I don't think they would say, no, that's a real castle. I think they would say that's,
well,
you know,
well, I thought it was. I
mean, this is causing me great pain, this stuff right now. But I mean, no, what you can get away with. I mean, if you think about Flash Gordon, you just couldn't do that film now, and you could then. And that's what I mean. Everybody saw the strings on Flash Gordon.
Okay, too, so yes, it would have been more acceptable in 1941 than it would be now to show something to an audience that was deliberately artificial in that way. We have an expectation now that things, you know, given all of our computer-generated technology, things are going to have a certain look, even if, I mean, 10 years ago, if you look at 10-year-old films and their CGI, they look so artificial, right? So we're not always aware of it, but we are always accepting certain things as real and other things as not real. But, you know, that makes me think about that moment in the film with the bird, that crazy moment when Susan's leaving, the bird's like, ah, and you get the little crazy shot of the bird that's so jolting. I mean, that's such a strange artificial moment, you know, again, just this kind of stylistic
thing. And also, I could tell, even though this was a digital, you know, print that doesn't have any real changes, there must have been a real change there, because there was like a split second where the bird's call was cut off a little bit, and as they you know, cut the heads and tails off the reels over and over again, you would lose a little bit more. So I could tell that since this was not a restoration, that there was just that little bit of that real, that's so film nerdy. I'm sorry.
That's awful nerdy, and I'm glad you did it. Yes, sir.
My name is Jeff Hayes, and I've seen the film a number of times. And part of its artfulness, I think, is that every time there's something new and rich to discover. It's not a plot-driven film. It's a film about character and watching the characters emerge. And to see the way the pieces fit together, for me, Rosebud is a significant thing. It does capture much of Kane's character. They're the themes of abandonment, loss of love, loss of control over his own life. And those are the things that get themselves worked out then. And seeing it a second time, you say, okay, the Rosebud is important, clearly. And then you can kind of trace through the film all the ways those themes are worked out. It's just a fascinating thing to me.
And in fact, it actually encourages repeated viewing in that way, because once you see it and you know what Rosebud is, then you want to go back to the beginning again and see if you can fit all the pieces together.
You know, and along those lines, I was thinking watching it tonight about the places that felt like real emotional moments in the film, which there's not that many. There's that one moment where Kane's eyes kind of well with tears. And then there's the beginning of the film where, I mean, that reaction of being taken away, that's more kind of a anger. But other than that, everything is kind of, I think, appropriately wrapped in all of this distance. You don't get a lot of kind of authentic emotion in this film, and it's partly why it doesn't feel like a melodrama, because it doesn't have those kinds of peaks and valleys that a lot of other films would have used.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Mitch Mulligan, and I was seeing it again, I forgot about how political it was, and I'm just wondering if it seems so sort of a cynical view where everything's sort of, you know, bad on each side, but do you think there's any kind of political statement, or is it just kind of this labyrinth like you were talking about of sort of obscure political statement that because it's hard to figure the political side to that.
I tell you what, I have a view on that, and I think it is deeply political, but it's all that you said, because it doesn't just polarize and give us the evil, corrupt politician and the crusader. And those films there were a lot of those in the late 40s and 50s with crusaders trying to bring down corruption. This is about a system because this is popular media. This is about manipulating the people. And you know that speech that Jedediah gives when Cain loses the election about, wait till you find out when the working man organizes what that's going to do to your newspaper.
I love that. Was one of my favorite things tonight. Yeah.
And so the people are a part of this film, and the people being co-opted and part of that mass culture that's buying these, who's buying these newspapers, who's buying these lies about someone being murdered because they're lost. That's us. So it's cynical in some ways, but I think it's also a pretty incisive look at what a materialistic culture like ours will breed. And you can try to blame one party or the other, but we're voting for them.
But this also really speaks to the Hearst situation, which is journalism as entertainment. I mean, that's what Hearst created. And we are all living in that world now, aren't we? Where that line between reporting and being entertained, and then what happens when there's no longer a line between the two. And so I think this film is thinking very presciently about that.
Yes, ma'am.
My name is Martha Dieter, and this is the first time I've seen the film. And the effect on him of being ripped away from his mother, and does that become a fatal flaw, the loss of love, and his quest for that?
Well, I'm going to answer that by not answering that and say something about that I noticed tonight watching it more than I ever have, which is there's something going on with the father, right? I mean, that the mother's line about, you know, I am going to get him away from you, there is some kind of backstory that's not spoken out loud in the film about the relationship, not just between the mother and father, but also between father and son. I think there's an implication of kind of brutality there.
But then I expected him to act differently to his own son, but that kid just disappeared.
Well, he was being asked to choose between love and money, and it was very clear that money had more value. So that was the value system that he internalized, because that was what his mother, whom he loved, seemed to be endorsing. That's the way it seems to me.
And yet, it's kind of interesting to actually think about what money means to Cain, though, because he seems to not be really concerned about spending it all. I mean, I love that line about, yes, I'm going to spend $1 million this year and $1 million next year, and I'll have 60 more years, and then it'll be done. And buying all of these things that he doesn't care about. I mean, what does money actually mean to him? And I think that's part of what this film is critiquing, is this idea of a kind of excess in materialism and its complete emptiness. I mean, clearly that house and being trapped in this big castle where you have these jigsaw puzzles and you're half a mile away from the person, you know, who you're married to, is a kind of perverse understanding of where money gets you.
Well, what he really traded for love was power. And the way he used money was a way of exerting power over people who ripped him out. I mean, think of how he flaunts money and his irresponsible attitude about money, which he hopes will irritate the life out of the man who tore him away. Thatcher, right? He's flaunting it. You know, you only care about money. For you, money is the whole thing. Watch what I care about it. Watch me burn $1 million a year. I hope that hurts you. Well, that's a power play, right? That's a power play. And it doesn't bring love, and it doesn't bring satisfaction. But in some way, for Charles Cain, there was a way of getting back, and that's a power play. So I think it's power more than money, although obviously there's
it's hard to untangle them sometimes.
Well, that's the deal. I want to thank all of you for being with us today, and our two wonderful film experts, Marcia Gordon, film professor at North Carolina State University, Laura Boys, film curator right here at North Carolina Museum of Art. Thank you very much, and thank you for joining us today. I'm a state attorney. I just want to say we're marking the two-year anniversary of Movies on the Radio next month. We want to hear from you. What topic do you want us to talk about? You can email your ideas at stateofthings.org or tweet us at #SOTMovie. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.